Okay, thanks everyone. Welcome to the last session. The programme says this is the penultimate session and there's a reflective discussion at the very end, but that reflective discussion will be very, very, very unreflective and brief. So we will be, there's some people who need to finish and get taxis and so on not long after three. So you'll be guaranteed to have left here before the 3:30 end. So our final speaker today is Professor Rosalind Duffy. Rosalind's had a number of prestigious appointments, Lancaster, Manchester, SOAS, but she hit the big time in September of this year when she joined us as Professor of International Politics here at the University of Sheffield. And I and the fellow Sharks were really pleased that she saw the light and came to join us in Sheffield, as many of you should too. Rosalind's work, she's examined, analysed, critiqued, interrogated conservation for a while now, most notably in her book, Killing for Conservation, which some of you will be aware of, and also the brilliant Nature Crime, Why We're Getting Conservation Wrong. At the moment, she's just started she's a principal investigator of a large ERC grant on, which is probably the last of its kind. So yay. Congratulations. This is a big European Union funding, for those of you that aren't aware. So she's the final beneficiary of a large ERC grant. To look at biodiversity and security. And I think you're going to speak to that topic in your keynote talk today.
I am. Thanks.
Okay, so
much.
Professor Rosalind Duffy.
Thanks so much. Well done everybody for making it to the end of the conference. I mean, one of the great things about being a keynote at the end is that you can kind of sweep in and say all these kind of very general things after everybody else has done some really hard work of presenting actual papers. So what this one is about is basically kind of sketching out some new dynamics in conservation. I'm very much at the beginning of a research project on this, as Alistair said. But I want to examine the ways that several global processes are converging in conservation practice in various parts of the world, not in all conservation practice, but in some conservation practices. So we have the dynamics of capitalism, we have technological innovation, and we also have concerns about global security. And what this is producing is an increasingly militarised and violent approach to protecting wildlife, characterised by the languages, technologies and practices of warfare. So I focus here on wildlife conservation, but the papers at this event amply demonstrate that conservation is more than wildlife conservation. I've always focused on wildlife conservation since the very beginning of my career, and I'm mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. If we examine conservation practice there, then it's clear how conservation intersects with race, gender, colonialism, capitalism, and most recently global security concerns. And one of the things I wanted to say was while I remain deeply critical of conservation practice, I got into this area and I remain in it because of a deep love and attachment to wildlife and a kind of a will to make conservation better in practice and more socially just. So conservation, I think, has long reflected a global context. So we have the top-down fortress-style conservation, which several of the papers spoke to, particularly earlier on today, which was introduced via colonialism. And in the 1990s, the commitment to decentralisation and democratisation was reflected in community-based natural resource management. And the devotion to market-based approaches was and still is evident in the development of the commodification of nature via processes like payments for ecosystem services, carbon forestry and ecotourism, to name a few. So these phases overlap, of course, and there are exceptions and alternative practices, but here I want to focus on what might be thought of as the dominant approach. And one good way of showing this is it's a very short 30-second clip of the Mbombi Parrobot, which brings together these three elements.
Thank you.
Now, the Mbombi Parrobot is the tagline that goes with him. Sorry, I'm trying to get rid of this first in case the next one starts, because there's a whole family of them. The tagline of the Mbombi Parrobot is that a superhero is born. He's nearly 10 metres tall and he weighs nearly a tonne, as he has a mission to protect Africa's rhino. And the Mbombi Parrobot is a marketing tool of the Paramount Group, which is South Africa's largest private defence contractor. But what they're actually selling is the armoured vehicle that you see at the start. And kind of 12-foot models of the Mbombi Parrobot are used at arms trade fairs to attract in attention and to normalise and regularise, sanitise sales of military equipment via an appeal to, we really want to be involved in conservation practice. And I found over the last few years, two years, that increasingly I am being invited to, or I'm finding that my presentations are being attended increasingly by military and intelligence services. And I began to wonder why this was the case, because it wasn't really it wasn't my natural habitat, it wasn't a comfortable habitat for me. I was used to being a university academic, just reflecting on things, and then having people turn up in combat fatigues was a tiny bit unsettling. But it's mirrored elsewhere. So we see very recent linkages, for instance, Vulcan Technology, which is a philanthropic arm of one of the founders of Microsoft, have teamed up with risk management companies, Reed, former spies, with Mars Omega, to develop surveillance technology in what they call the fight to save endangered species. So what's really going on here? And I want to look at a political ecology framework to analyse the integration and of security and biodiversity, which is producing new opportunities for capital accumulation. So Massey and Lundstrom have called these new dynamics accumulation by securitisation, and I think this really deserves further investigation. So accumulation by securitisation, they analyse the Greater Lebombo Conservancy in South Africa, which draws together these sort of intersections of neoliberalism, security and conservation. And rising rates of rhino poaching in South Africa have driven new patterns of accumulation as part of the drive by the state and the private sector to conserve and secure species. So the Conservancy draws together private land in a frontier zone where massive tracts of land have been enclosed and consolidated for the purposes of wildlife conservation and the expansion of tourism-related investments, especially around wildlife security. But the primary rationale behind the GLC is that it acts as a securitised buffer zone to protect the Kruger National Park, and most importantly, its rhinos, by halting the cross-border movement of people/poachers from Mozambique. So on first glance, this might look like more established processes of green grabbing, of accumulation by dispossession. But I do think, and I agree with Massey and Lundstrom here, that something new is happening. It's not just green grabbing. It's accumulation and securitisation together. These dynamics have also been described as new forms of green violence by Busher and Ramutsindela, particularly in South Africa, where there's a ramping up of the war on poachers via increasingly militarised approaches. This isn't confined to South Africa. We've seen nor to domestic security concerns either. Lots of governments are facing growing rates of elephant and rhino poaching. And from around about 2013, I'll go back to the previous slide. Around about 2013, conservation NGOs have articulated the need to conserve iconic species, notably tigers, elephants, rhinos, but now increasingly actually pangolins have been added to the mix as a means of contributing to global security. So that conservation practice is linked with arguments about how to tackle organised crime, prevent money laundering and prevention of terrorism. And while arguments about poaching and wildlife trafficking are increasingly talked about under a wider banner of wildlife crime and the production of threat finance, which threatens global stability. So, as with historical dynamics of enclosure, the current dynamics of accumulation and securitisation are accompanied by new forms of exclusion, by violent dispossessions and by militarised strategies from the combined power of states, conservation NGOs and the private sector, including the sort of private military company sector. First, I think I need to go back to some earlier work that I did around the neoliberalisation of nature, because this in a sense laid the groundwork for our, for what I think of as a current phase of a security phase. So the debate in geography, particularly around the neoliberalisation of nature, is basically focuses on the way that new frontiers in non-human nature, and I know that's a problematic term, but I'll stick with it for now. New frontiers of non-human nature have been opened to capitalist logics via processes of commodification. So I'm thinking particularly of work by Cathy McAfee, by Noel Castry, Brenner and Theodore, and also by Bram Buscher. And that this commodification allows an environmental fix so that we sell nature to save it at its most basic. Ecotourism in particular intersects with this kind of idea of last chance to see tourism. So that it captures and defines certain aspects of nature as deeply threatened and mobilises arguments about scarcity and precarity as a rationale for the creation of new attractions. So it's promoted as an opportunity to witness and to consume the demise of ecosystems, the extinction of species, or even ecocide at first hand. This creation of new commodities out of nature is important for understanding the current intersections with security. So biodiversity conservation, I would argue, is undergoing a significant transition. And this neoliberal phase has laid the groundwork for the security phase. So this security phase, we're more used to the idea that climate change constitutes a global security threat. It's been a central academic and policy debate. And it revolves around concerns that environmental change will reduce the productivity of land, of fisheries, and will ultimately lead to greater levels of armed conflict. I feel that that's a deeply problematic argument, but it's one that's now been extended into biodiversity conservation. But it has a particular form in biodiversity conservation, which is captured by Achim Steiner, the UN Undersecretary General of UNEP, who's now moved to the Martin School, I think, in Oxford. I can't remember the exact title. And his argument is indicative of a broader argument that the scale and role of wildlife and forest crime in threat finance calls for wider policy attention. So again, we have this idea that wildlife trafficking in particular and poaching produce significant sources of threat finance, first as a lucrative business for organised crime networks in Europe and Asia, and second as a source of finance for militias and terrorist networks, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, but most notably Al-Shabaab, Lord's Resistance Army, Janjaweed, and most recently Boko Haram. So threats to biodiversity from the illegal wildlife trade are framed as a security issue in conceptual terms as well as in policy debates. And this environmental crime approach frames biodiversity losses as a security issue because it's assumed that organised crime and terrorist groups use illegal wildlife trade, particularly ivory poaching, but not just ivory, to generate threat finance. So the sort of value of wildlife trafficking is estimated, this is just the illegal trade, around about 7.8 to 10 billion per annum. But again, that's probably an underestimate. It's very difficult to get figures on illegal activities. And the increasing sophistication of wildlife trafficking networks is a reflection of their link to other serious offences, including theft, fraud, corruption, drugs and human trafficking. If I think back to a really long time ago when I was doing research for Nature Crime, back in probably 2008, 2009, interviewing the head of the UK National Wildlife Crime Unit, who was in a tiny cottage in Berwick in Scotland, while he bemoaned the fact that no one in the government took his role seriously, because and he would constantly try and make the argument that people who were involved in hare coursing and badger baiting were also involved in other wider forms of criminality like drug trafficking and so on, and that if you took wildlife crime seriously, you would also catch criminals who were responsible for much bigger crimes. That was his argument. And we've come a long way in 6 or 7 years, because now this sort of argument is at the top of many international policy agendas. So no longer is he stuck in a cottage in Berwick. Now it's part of kind of serious organised crime initiatives across Europe, United States and elsewhere. So there's a sort of evolving relationship, I think, going on between them. And major donors are also taking this issue very seriously indeed. Tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars have been made available in the last 2 years for anti-poaching and anti-trafficking initiatives, particularly in areas of US geostrategic interest. So in 2013, the Clinton Global Initiative announced a commitment to raise $80 million. The Howard G. Buffett Foundation gave $25 million for rhino protection in Kruger National Park. And these concerns emerged as a policy initiative of the UK after Prince Charles told DEFRA in 2014 that they needed to have a response. And the response is a £15 million illegal wildlife trade challenge fund administered from DFID through DEFRA. And in 2016, the EU also produced the EU Action Plan Against Wildlife Trafficking and the Fight Against Terrorist Financing. And both of those action plans make direct reference to the idea that poaching and trafficking fund terrorist networks. But there's a question mark about whether any of this is actually real, whether any of it is credible. So there are really questionable claims around whether Ivory in particular actually does fund organised crime and terrorist activity. So in a recent report from UNEP, the argument that Al-Shabaab was being funded by trading 30.6 tonnes of ivory per annum was described as highly unreliable. It's also quite clear from other sources of data that the Lord's Resistance Army probably only traffic two tusks that they get hold of through trading, not through direct poaching, and the elephant poaching in the areas they operate in is actually down to elements of the Sudanese army and police. But the story has stuck, and the question is why. So why are they being integrated in this way? In some senses, it makes good copy. It's been the source of several articles in National Geographic and The New Yorker as well. And governments have also continuously repeated it. Conservation organisations, many of them, have also continually repeated it, although some have started to pull back because they recognise that actually the evidence for making these claims is actually really rather thin and mostly comes from a single report by one NGO called Elephant Action League, who made the claim based on one interview that one of their contacts did in Somalia. And so a whole global narrative has been built on this really tiny piece of evidence. In fact, in terms of academic impact stories, for anyone who's interested in impact case study, it's a pretty brilliant one. So why have they been integrated? So I want to argue that the integration of biodiversity and security has emerged out of both the tandem processes of neoliberalisation of nature and the development of a much wider global context in which fears about national and global security have risen to prominence. So conservation exists in a particular global context. It needs to attract funds either from private sponsors or from national governments and international institutions. And being able to make the argument that conservation contributes to global security allows conservation NGOs to tap into the much greater levels of funding available in that sector. But this is only part of the explanation. So there's a kind of a crude follow the money kind of analysis in there. And follow the money works to a certain degree, but it doesn't explain everything, I think. It's also suited to the interests of the various protagonists. So it suited the interests of militaries, particularly demobilised members of the military, because seeking to find a new role, and also private military companies seeking to find new markets. So one example of the demobilised military is the sudden appearance of several, probably more than 200 or 300, former combatants from who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan who can't reintegrate themselves into civilian life and are appearing all over the world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, offering their services for free to anti-poaching outfits, to private anti-poaching companies. And some of the private anti-poaching companies have said, you know, we're not interested, but some have taken them on. So there's something interesting going on there, I think, about the demobilisation of militaries from major conflicts around the world and how they then find a new role in the world. National governments, it's also suited their interests in terms of arguing about security, and also international organisations. So the tandem processes of neoliberalisation of nature and the rising prominence of global security concerns, I think, are discernible in four critical global shifts. So there's the development of a global context, which has extended security concerns, most obviously in a US-led war on terror, so that for governments, particularly parks and wildlife departments, conservation NGOs and private conservation organisations, the ability to claim that their activities will contribute to national and global security has provided an important opportunity to justify their operations and justify their continued existence. It's also given an opportunity to leverage additional funds, as I've pointed out, several philanthropic foundations, but also major government investment in the area. And the development of this global context in which security is a leading concern has opened new opportunities. So as with the kind of humanitarian relief sector in the 1990s, Cooley and Ron point out that NGOs in the humanitarian sector were increasingly kind of engaged in a competitive market to secure funding and contracts with donors. And this dynamic is now mirrored in the conservation sector as well. And this partly explains why conservation organisations have been so keen to promote the idea that what they do is critical to security. I think the second set of arguments that we can be making, actually I should just very quickly explain this picture. It's taken at the World Parks Congress, and the person in the light khaki shirt is Damien Mander, who is an Australian Marine who has moved to who served in Afghanistan and Iraq, and has moved to Mozambique to set up an anti-poaching operation. And he was one of the first people to start using drone technology to seek out poachers. But his project has been criticised both by conservationists and by other groups as well, and it's not clear whether the project has really had any impact on poaching, but certainly gets lots of media attention. Good story, you know, sort of big marine demobilised, seeking to apply the lessons, this is the way he puts it, I want to apply the lessons I learned in Iraq to anti-poaching in Mozambique. So it was interesting, this was his display at the World Parks Congress, and it generated a lot of interest and a lot of activity. So the second one is also kind of captured by that image as well, which is the increasing application of military-type technologies and military approaches to wildlife conservation. This isn't necessarily a new thing. There's been a very long history of relationship between conservation and the military, and military approaches. So, for example, the suppression of Mau Mau uprising in Kenya, parks rangers were also engaged in that alongside regular military. And also, since the early 1990s, Botswana has used the Botswana Defence Force in joint operations with the Department of Wildlife and National Parks. So I'm not claiming this is necessarily a brand new thing. There are antecedents. But what I think it's overlain with now, particularly somewhere like Botswana, but also South Africa, use the argument that wildlife is emblematic, is national and natural heritage, which is used then to justify a militarised approach. And in some contexts, not in necessarily in South Africa, but yes, in Botswana and also in Uganda and Tanzania, is used to justify a shoot-on-sight policy to anyone suspected of poaching. So these approaches aren't confined to Africa either. They're mirrored in the development of Green Forces battalions in the Petén region of Guatemala as well. So Megan Yibera notes that during a 36-year civil war in Guatemala, the military discursively presented lowland rainforest regions of Petén as dangerous areas which harboured potential insurgents. And the end of the civil war saw the rise of a transnational alliance with international conservation NGOs and the new government of Guatemala, which reconfigured the region of Petén as a dangerous refuge for insurgents and for drug traffickers. So the sort of some of the groups in that area went from being referred to as kind of narco peasants, suddenly became referred to as narco-terrorists. As long as the word narco was in front of it, that was what was kind of continuing to justify the security aspect of it. So a third explanation is innovations in military and surveillance technologies, which means we can simply do more things in more contexts. We can collect more information in lots of different kinds of ways. So for surveillance purposes in particular, there's the sort of expansion of new types of technology have driven a demand to find new markets to expand its use and profitability. So one of the first times I came across this was when I was doing a piece of work for DEFRA, which gave me incredible access to all the rhino coordinators in sub-Saharan Africa. And one story that kept coming back from all of them was the number of times they were being approached by privately owned drone companies, asking them to put funds into purchasing drones as a cheap and effective way of surveilling poachers. And they were getting really fed up of it. They didn't want the money to be invested in that. What they wanted was for their staff to be well paid, paid on time, have good equipment and be treated well. Buying a big drone makes a better story than providing someone with a good sleeping bag and some nice boots, which might actually be a more effective approach. So this sort of new field of digital conservation is expanding, and it's not just surveillance technologies, it's also there in citizen science, crowdsourcing, e-gaming, data connectivity and decision-making support systems. But there are growing intersections between new forms of military and surveillance technology that are evident in the new range of surveillance networks, which seek to draw together government agencies, intelligence agencies, wildlife conservation NGOs, and private sector risk analysis companies. So we see new actors arising in conservation. So the bottom picture is a screenshot of the front page of Maisha Consulting, which interestingly is run by one of the people who created the report on Al-Shabaab, claiming that they were funded by ivory poaching. And Maisha Consulting has gone around sub-Saharan Africa in particular, offering their services to train in anti-poaching, but also to implement anti-poaching programmes. And they've even been contracted by organisations like WWF to deliver anti-poaching in certain protected areas. And again, we can see that this is reflective of a global context in which private military companies has now become a normal approach to in warfare. We now accept, rightly or wrongly, in my view wrongly, we accept the idea that private military companies are a legitimate and an appropriate actor in major interventions around the world. They're very present, or were very present, in Iraq and Afghanistan. So Maisha Consulting describes itself as a provider of environmental security via special investigations, training and operations in complex security situations. And also for some governments and for some conservation NGOs, that's very attractive. Many representatives of conservation organisations will tell you, and I agree with them, that they, in their kind of mission to save certain endangered species, some of them live in some of the most complex and unstable regions of the world. So Wildlife Conservation Society, for example, has always been present in the DRC all the way through the various phases of warfare in DRC. And that wildlife conservationists are often not equipped to deal with these very complex security situations. So I'll finish up with a kind of a conclusion of why any of this matters, and why any of us should be concerned about any of this at all, beyond a kind of academic debate of discussing the integration of security and biodiversity, which is valuable in and of itself. So for me, conservation is shifting from a neoliberal phase into a security phase, which has opened up new opportunities for capital accumulation. This shift has been facilitated by a rise in illegal hunting of elephants and rhinos in particular in sub-Saharan Africa, and the development and deployment of new forms of surveillance technology, and the production of a discursive link between poaching and terrorism. These are the core themes that are usually more commonly associated with narratives around global security, but they've been effectively operationalised in a new narrative around defence and protection of wildlife, so that it's become more possible to consider and authorise the use of deadly force in defence of wildlife. And I think we need to be think about what that really means. So sometimes I'll confront people with when they say, "Well, you know, we should, we need to engage in really aggressive anti-poaching and knock out these poachers." Well, what does that mean? It means authorising extrajudicial executions of people who are suspected of poaching. That's something we need to be careful about thinking about. To see, are we comfortable with that? Personally, I'm not. So while conservation has a very long history of using violent methods, I'm not saying that that's a brand new thing, because previously conservation has used conservationists have used shoot to kill and justified shoot to kill. The current phase differs, I think, partly because it develops conservation activity as part of a global security agenda. So using force to protect elephants, rhinos, tigers, pangolins maybe in the future, lions almost certainly in the future, I would think, because they've also been added to the list of iconic species, produces a new context which also is justified as a win-win of conservation and security, and allows new forms of enclosure by conservation NGOs, the private sector and states in tandem with one another. So its proponents characterise it as this win-win. But there's a real possibility, or not even just a possibility, but probability, that this will be counterproductive in the long run, because it's the wrong diagnosis for what's happening. It's the wrong diagnosis for what the current problems that conservation faces, the current problems that wildlife face, and this wrong diagnosis has material outcomes on the ground which are very negative or ineffectual for the very people who live with wildlife. And many of the people who live with the sort of big charismatic species, the elephants, the rhinos, the tigers, the lions, are amongst the most marginalised, poorest and most vulnerable communities in the world. But their interests may well be swept aside in the search for kind of global security articulated via wildlife conservation. Thanks very much.